thank my guests, Professor of International Human Rights, Daniel Cavalli, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, thanks to a national co-director of the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders, joining us from New York. Also, a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
Thank you.
Good night.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah hath power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time, and Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Syria calls on the UN Security Council to immediately move to end Washington's acts of aggression and crimes against the war-torn country. Violence erupts during fresh protests in the Spanish city of Barcelona over the jailing of a Catalan singer on charges of insulting the monarchy. Also ahead, the U.S. approves a third coronavirus vaccine for emergency use days after the death toll from the pandemic in the country topped half a million. Welcome to the program. Syria calls on the UN Security Council to take measures to stop what it calls U.S. acts of aggression against the Arab country. In a letter addressed to the UN Secretary General and President of the Security Council, Syrian Foreign Ministry condemned the recent U.S. airstrike on Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups on the Syrian border. The ministry warned that such actions can escalate tensions in the region. The U.S. attack also drew condemnation from the director of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Ali Shamkhani slammed the raid as an act of organized terrorism aimed at boosting Daesh terrorists. Shamkhani made the remarks during a meeting with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein. Political analyst John Bosnich says U.S. President Joe Biden has proven that he is not a more moderate politician than his predecessor only weeks into his term in office.
Let's start things off first from where I'm sitting. I'm sitting here in New York City in the United States, where the people of America elected a president who they were told was a more moderate, more rational, and more responsible leader. Well, we've now had that proven wrong within barely a month of taking office, because he has taken an unprovoked act of war against a sovereign state on the other side of the planet. That's point one. So all of those voters were deceived, and I'm glad to see that there are people around the world who are not deceived by these tales. Then we talk about the legal situation. This act of war, this targeted attack on a foreign sovereign state, is not only a violation of U.S. law, it's a violation of international law, and thus the UN Security Council should be brought into play here. But unfortunately, we know that the United States exercises a veto there. And so, actually, justice is unattainable.
U.S. President Joe Biden has sent a letter to Congress explaining his justification for Thursday's airstrikes in eastern Syria, close to the Iraqi border. In the letter, Biden said aerial raids were carried out in self-defense, adding that they meant to protect U.S.-led foreign troops in Iraq against rocket attacks. The attack targeted the positions of Iraqi counter-terrorism forces. The U.S. has time and again blamed Iraqi resistance groups. Group status for targeting American mission and forces. The assault on Syria was the first of its kind under the new U.S. administration. However, it has been criticized by some Democrats in U.S. Congress. The raid also sparked international condemnations. Well, I'll be discussing this with Mr. Edward Corrigan. He's an international human rights lawyer who joins us via Skype out of Ontario. It's good to have you with us, sir. Your reaction to this, did you really hope that Mr. Biden's administration would act differently in these areas, like many other people had hoped before he was chosen president?
Well, yes, I hoped that he was going to pursue a more moderate line, and that they were going to emphasize diplomacy, not armed aggression. But unfortunately, Joe Biden, as president, has a long history of supporting military actions in the Middle East. He is a supporter, for example, the American attack on Iraq, which I think all commentators recognize was a disaster for the United States, but also certainly a disaster for the people of Iraq. Biden has very much stacked his cabinet with sort of war hawks, people that are very friendly to Israel and support the use of arms force to get America's objectives. And even though those objectives sometimes are very confusing, and actually nobody can figure out what they're doing unless you take a really nasty sort of view of things. Biden is, and critics of Biden and have pointed out that there's a difference between, Joe Biden Democrats and, the Republicans under Trump or even under Bush when it comes to domestic policy. But there's almost no difference whatsoever when it comes to foreign policy. They're, strong supporters of Israel, always use the resort to violence to accomplish their goals, and of course, using sanctions to punish their enemies or to try to accomplish whatever their political objectives are. But, Joe Biden describes this as, self-defense. If this is self-defense, then I'd like to sell you some land on the moon, because this is not self-defense. This is an act of aggression, but also it doesn't make sense because the people they attacked are actually fighting, Daesh, the Islamic State. And the United States says, oh, we're there to fight, Daesh and the Islamic State. But then they assassinated General Soleimani and the commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Force, which were the most effective forces fighting the Islamic State, as are these other groups. Iran and Iraq and Syria have all been fighting the Islamic State. And the United States says they fight it. But when you look at what they do, they keep bombing the Syrians, keep bombing the Iraqis. They assassinate General Soleimani and other leaders that have been actually most effective in fighting the Islamic State. So it really rips off the cover. It shows the United States is using and supporting ISIS and Daesh, and they're accomplishing Israel's goal to try to keep all these countries destabilized. And of course, the United States is ignoring the will of the Iraqi people and the Iraqi parliament, which unanimously passed a resolution calling for the withdrawal of the American soldiers. So the Americans are punching, and I guess Biden is sending a message. But, I don't know what sort of message is going to be sent by the military forces and popular mobilization units in Iraq and other organizations and units that are fighting Daesh. But the United States seems to be trying to reestablish Daesh in the area to give them a pretext to stay in the area. They're illegally in Syria. They're building a military base there. And they're stealing oil. Mm-hmm. All of these things make no sense. And in fact, they're are clearly illegal under international law. But also, it's hard to see what sort of advantage the United States is going to get out of this, because it's antagonizing the whole region, other than, as I said, pirating the oil and stealing it. But this has got some condemnation now from some Democratic members of Congress, which is a start. And you have international condemnation. And of course, this is totally illegal. And this is not an act of self-defense. This is an act of aggression, and should be condemned, and the Americans, if they want to be consistent and solve the problems in the area, they need to change their policy completely.
Sure. Many, many thanks. That's Mr. Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer out of London, Ontario. The United Nations says thousands of people have been displaced following the renewed clashes in the Yemeni province of Ma'arib. Earlier, we discussed that issue in detail with our guests in our news review program.
And I welcome everyone up to the news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, the United Nations says that thousands of Yemeni civilians have been displaced amid intensified clashes between Saudi-backed forces and the Ansarullah movement in Ma'arib province. UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said violence displaced over 8,000 people in the first week of February, Ma'arib, where latest clashes have occurred, already hosts some 1 million displaced civilians. According to the International Organization for Migration, some of the people in the displacement sites have been at least three times forcibly relocated. Meanwhile, dozens of troops have reportedly been killed in renewed clashes since Saturday. The Ansarullah movement says its Ma'arib offensive is aimed at protecting the citizens who the UN says Saudi-backed militants are using as human shields. Joining us now for this news review is Zafar Bangesh, director at the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto, Canada, and James Tweedy, journalist and commentator, joining us from Plymouth out of the UK. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there with you, Mr. Bangesh. Hope you're doing well. Good to have you back on the news review program. It seems like every day we get a new word out of Yemen. Things are just getting worse. Just when you think they can't get any worse, they seem to somehow manage to get worse. Your thoughts on what's going on in that country?
Well, basically, as we know, the Saudis have waged this illegal war against the people of Yemen now coming close to 6 years. And during this time, their primary targets have been the civilian population, because the Saudi army and its allies are cowards. They are unable to fight a straightforward conventional war, so they resort to targeting civilians, destroying their infrastructure, bombing hospitals, schools, etc. And of course, they have imposed a terrible siege on Yemen. They can't get medicines in, food is at a very short supply. And as in your introduction, you pointed out that fighting around Ma'arib has now led to the displacement of thousands of people, not for the first time, in fact, for the third time for some of them. And they are in the refugee camps. The situation is terrible. And if the fighting continues, perhaps another 400,000 or so people may be displaced one more time. And as we know, the UN has pointed out repeatedly that the children of Yemen are suffering terribly. There are more than 1 million children that suffer from cholera. And this is all as a result of the Saudi aggression against the people of Yemen, which unfortunately is also backed by the United States, Britain, France, and the Zionist regime. So we know that there are a whole lot of players involved that are supporting the Saudi war crimes in Yemen against the civilian population.
Thank you, sir. And James Tweedy, I'd like to welcome you to the program. It's been a while since we've spoken. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. Your initial thoughts on all this?
Well, thanks for having me. I'd say that, firstly, it's a horrible situation for the people who have been displaced. In fact, have been displaced several times, as you say. But it has to be viewed in the context of the wider war. And, you know, this war would not have occurred if it was not for the... it occurred by the choice of the Saudi government, essentially, and the coalition, such as it is, that supports the Saudi government in this. So the Saudis chose to initiate this war, although they say they're acting in self-defense, and this is what creates the overall situation. And it's very hard to see how the army of a country can, or the armed forces generally, including guerrillas, can eject an occupying army from its territory without fighting over it and without causing situations like this. So it is unfortunate, but it's also inevitable. We have to say that, as my fellow guest said, the Saudis have subjected the country to Yemen to a long blockade, including at the port of Hodeidah, which has been under siege for several years now. And we don't see too much talk from the UN about about that this week. Okay, so yes, we have to. You know, you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. And if the, you know, the ultimate blame lies on the aggressor in this war.
Time has gotten the better of us. Joining us, Mr. Zafar Bangesh, director from the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto. Thank you, gentlemen, for both of you. And James Tweedy, journalist and commentator, joining us out of Plymouth. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
The United States has approved the third coronavirus vaccine for emergency use days after the death toll from the pandemic in the country topped 500,000. The Food and Drug Administration said the single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine is highly effective at preventing severe COVID cases. That's amid concerns over the vaccine's only 72% efficacy in clinical trials. The figure falls significantly short of the earlier approved vaccines that have over 90% efficacy. President Biden has, however, hailed the approval of the new vaccine as exciting news, but he warned against Americans letting their guard down. COVID-19 has infected an average 69,000 people in the U.S. over the past week. That is a plateau authorities are trying to break with new jabs. The U.S. remains the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic, both in terms of infections and deaths. Brazil's health ministry reports over 1,300 new coronavirus deaths for the fifth day in a row. The country also registered nearly 62,000 infection cases over the past day. Brazil has suffered an enduring second wave since November, and infection rates have not begun to fall. The country imposed lockdown measures in the capital city, Brasilia, to combat the surge in cases. According to official data, the country has so far registered more than 10.5 million infections since the pandemic began, and nearly 255,000 deaths. Elsewhere in Latin America, Mexico logged over 750 new fatalities, raising its total death toll to over 185,000. Meanwhile, in Argentina, thousands of people took to the streets of Buenos Aires to protest a VIP vaccine scandal that has shaken up the government. To Europe now, and EU leaders expressed concern over the spread of COVID-19 variants within the 27-nation bloc amid criticism that vaccines are being administered too slowly. The handling of the pandemic in the EU is contributing to economic uncertainty and social inequality. Jerome Hughes reports.
Like millions of other young people in the EU, Charles Prevost feels he has not been given adequate support by authorities during the pandemic. In order to survive, the entrepreneur has purchased his own hot dog stand, which he operates in Brussels.
I was working on a restaurant, I was managing a restaurant, and I lost my job, and I was like, what I can do next, what we can do, what the young people, the young men, the young ladies in this world, in this city, in this country, what they can do, because we don't have any help.
As businesses continue to fold in the EU and millions lose their jobs, people feel there is no hope. Only 6.4% of the bloc's population have received a vaccine. That's tiny compared to the UK and US. A two-day video conference involving EU leaders has just concluded. They are very concerned about COVID-19 mutations. Variants are allowed to flourish when people are not vaccinated. Experts say the bureaucratic structures of the EU have resulted in citizens having to wait far too long for vaccines. However, EU leaders say producers are not keeping their promises in terms of supply.
We want more predictability and transparency to ensure that pharmaceutical companies comply with their commitments.
Health officials warn mixed messages from EU leaders about the efficacy of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine are making citizens reluctant to take the jab. Two other vaccines have been approved here, but supply remains a big problem. A fourth vaccine from Johnson & Johnson is likely to be approved next month. During their summit, EU leaders talked at length about the importance of developing certificates to show people have been vaccinated in order to open up travel. Commentators are describing this as laughable, saying it is putting the cart before the horse, given the current state of play with respect to the rollout of vaccines.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Fresh protests are held in the Spanish city of Barcelona as the unrest over the jailing of Catalan singer Pablo Hasél shows no signs of abating. Protesters vandalized shops and banks and set trash bins on fire. Police made 10 arrests. Hasél was arrested last week and sentenced to 9 months in jail on charges of glorifying terrorism and insulting the Spanish monarchy in his songs and tweets. The arrest has sparked the debate on the freedom of expression in that country. One person is killed and several wounded in Myanmar as police crack down on protesters to end weeks of demonstrations against the February 1st military coup. The protester was reportedly killed after the police opened fire on demonstrators in the town of Dawei. According to witnesses, the police also threw stun grenades, used tear gas, and fired into the air to disperse protesters in the city of Yangon. The latest fatality brings to four the number of anti-coup protesters killed so far. Myanmar was thrown into chaos when the army seized power and detained elected government officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The military claims the November election, in which Suu Kyi's party won with a landslide, was rigged. The coup has drawn condemnation from many countries.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth,
Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Texas isn't the only U.S. state that allows its residents to choose between energy providers, but a model of energy system that led to the recent power crisis is built upon a shaky framework, says Sharon Zhang, news writer, in an article published under the heading, Texas Power Grid Deregulation Costs Texans $28 billion over two decades. Stay tuned for more. A new analysis by the Wall Street Journal, WSJ, has found that the deregulation and monopolization of the Texas energy market cost Texas residents $28 billion more than they would have paid under a traditional utility. When Texas changed from fully regulated power generation to the largely deregulated system that's in place today, it began requiring almost 60% of residents to buy from retail utilities rather than a public local utility, says WSJ. Retail providers buy energy and then sell it at a fixed rate and essentially acting as a middleman. Texas isn't the only state in the U.S. that allows its residents to choose between energy providers, but a model of energy system that led to last week's power crisis is built upon a shaky framework. Ironically, the deregulatory effort was supposed to make power cheaper for consumers while avoiding federal oversight. When a Republican state senator who helped lead the charge for deregulation of Texas grid in 1990s alongside lobbyists and businesses like Enron unveiled the deregulation bill in 1999, WSJ noted that he said, "If all consumers don't benefit from this, we will have wasted our time and failed our constituency. Competition in the electric industry will benefit Texans by reducing monthly rates," said then-Governor George W. Bush, per WSJ. Deregulation, according to these lawmakers, stated intentions didn't work as planned. From 2004 to 2019, WSJ found, while the average rate paid by Texas residents getting their electricity from traditional utilities was 8% lower than the average across the U.S., the average rate among retail providers was 13% higher than the nationwide rate. As Bush noted, deregulation was also supposed to allow for more competition, but various mergers have left the state with only two main retail electricity providers. A 2014 report by the Texas Coalition for Affordable Power, TCAP, had similar findings to WSJ. At a time, the organization found that residents in deregulated areas paid $22 billion more than people in regulated areas of Texas. A follow-up report in 2019 by TCAP found that the gap had since narrowed, but that the system has a long way to go, said TCAP's executive director. WSJ's findings are in light of some conservatives doubling down on defending the deregulated energy system in Texas after the crisis began. Last week, former Texas Governor Rick Perry said that Texans would rather face the energy crisis that ballooned into what some called a Hurricane Katrina-scale disaster that faced regulation from the federal government. Governor Greg Abbott, meanwhile, went on Fox to blame the energy crisis on renewable energy, even though the crisis was largely due to natural gas generation failures and attacked the Green New Deal. However, in the wake of the disaster, climate experts have pointed out that the Green New Deal could actually be instrumental in helping to prevent future disasters like this one. The winter storm that knocked out the grid in Texas has been attributed to the climate crisis, since climate change causes unusual and often disastrous weather conditions. Though climate scientists have warned of such changes for many years, many energy regulators continue to largely ignore the effects of the climate crisis, including Texas grid operator. In an interview with Texas Monthly, the president of the state's grid operator said, "We don't have any climate specialists on staff. It remains to be seen how much consumers will end up paying out of pocket for the past week of energy price spikes in the state. But experts are saying that they will likely to be paying more. Some residents who chose to get their energy from wholesale providers were hit with bills of up to $16,000 last week for just a few days' worth of energy use. Others may see a rise in their rates eventually."
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Brereton Report, released in late 2020, documents alleged war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan. An inquiry into war crimes committed there by British Special Forces as well was also concluded just a few months earlier, with many similarities. This is a topic that is often overlooked and underreported, especially given the severity of the crimes. Let's take a closer look at what we learned from these inquiries. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 2001, Australia invaded Afghanistan along with the United States and the United Kingdom. 20 years later, these countries are still occupying Afghanistan after promising they would bring peace and stability. Stupendous amounts of money, resources, and manpower have gone towards this occupation, all in the name of nation building. And as it turns out, a lot of these resources have been used to commit horrific acts against the people of Afghanistan. In late 2020, an inquiry into war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan was finally released. This 465-page report, titled the Brereton Report, was initiated in 2016 and took several years to complete. The report found that 39 Afghan civilians were alleged to have been unlawfully killed by or involving Australian Defence Force members. None of these alleged crimes took place in the heat of battle, and the victims were non-combatants or no longer combatants. The report is broken down into three parts. However, a lot of it is heavily redacted. Not just the names of individuals, but in some cases, entire events are redacted. One of the shocking practices revealed in this report is known as blooding. This practice is another extremely disturbing aspect of these war crimes. Essentially, what would happen is you'd have a platoon commander who would take a new squad member and have them execute a detained prisoner. The prisoner would be unarmed, in cuffs, and posing no threat whatsoever. The term used in this report is also of interest because they referred to this as an unlawful killing. What it really is an execution. It's cold-blooded murder. Calling it an unlawful killing is just a way to water down the horror of what we're discussing here. But you can't do that. What we're talking about here are war crimes. We're talking about murder. There is no way to sugarcoat atrocities like this. Another practice that we're also made aware of is throwdowns. Basically, what this means is that special forces would carry weapons that are not regularly issued by the Australian or British military and then plant them on a prisoner after executing them. They would throw it down on the ground next to them, a throwdown. This would make it look like the prisoner wasn't executed, but instead killed during a firefight or because they had supposedly pulled a knife, for example. None of which was true, of course. It's important to note that the Brereton Report is not, in fact, a criminal investigation, but an inquiry conducted by the Inspector General of the Australian Defence Force. This is a role that is separate from the chain of command in the Australian Armed Forces and is appointed by the Secretary of Defence. The Brereton Report makes a number of recommendations following the inquiry, some criminal, others promotions, others pardons. However, it's not clear which cases they're referring to because a lot of it has been redacted. Again, another war crime, which didn't come from the Brereton Report, but it's still one of the most striking nonetheless, is a video that was released by Four Corners. It shows three men from the Australian SAS chasing an Afghan farmer with a German shepherd. They catch up to him and gather around him as he's lying on the ground. At one point, one of the SAS can be heard asking if he should drop the man. There's an inaudible answer, after which we see him execute the Afghan farmer at point-blank range using his machine gun. It's sickening, it's grotesque, and it's a war crime that makes someone feel physically ill just by watching it. The man who was executed in the video was 26 years old. His name was Dad Muhammad. They said later that he was carrying a radio, supposedly, and that this proved that he was an insurgent, and that's why they killed him. This turned out to be a lie. There was no radio recovered. And even if there was, one has to ask the question, how does carrying a radio merit an execution at point-blank range? After the release of the Brereton Report, a Chinese official posted a doctored image on Twitter of an Australian soldier with a knife in reference to the war crimes committed by their special forces. What's interesting here isn't so much the image, but the reaction it garnered, particularly from Australian officials. Australia's parliament was outraged by it, and Australia's prime minister issued a statement rebuking the Chinese government, demanding an apology. Apparently, the Australian government is more offended by people exposing and calling out its war crimes than the actual war crimes themselves perpetrated by its own soldiers. David McBride, a former lawyer and major in the Australian Defence Force, leaked evidence of war crimes to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC. After this happened, ABC's offices were raided by police. And I think it's extremely interesting and worth pointing out here that when supposedly liberal democracies like the United States, Australia, and the UK have embarrassing information about them leaked to the press, all notions of freedom of speech and press freedoms suddenly seem to go out the window. We saw this with the raid on ABC, with the persecution of Julian Assange, and numerous other whistleblowers across the years. After leaking evidence of war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan to ABC, David McBride faces 5 charges, including those of theft of Commonwealth property, breaching the Defence Act, and disclosing information without due authorization. This could result in him going to jail for decades. He joins me now to talk more. Thanks for taking the time, David. It's good to have you on.
Thank you, Richard.
So, David, I want to start out with the prosecution that you're up against. You're facing several decades in jail now because you exposed war crimes committed by the SAS in Afghanistan. You detail how you tried going up the chain of command, and they put these roadblocks and obstacles in front of you. Can you maybe elaborate on some of the mechanisms that an institution like the Australian military, perhaps the British and the American military, might put in place to prevent whistleblowers like you from disclosing the truth and exposing wrongdoing?
It wasn't war crimes that I first noticed a problem. It was more that we didn't tell the truth about anything, about small things as well as big things. That the war looked like it was being run to win domestic elections rather than to actually make a difference in Afghanistan. And I started to get suspicious because when I made complaints, they weren't treated seriously. And in fact, the message that seemed to be coming back to me was, shut up, stop making waves, what's going on is way above your pay grade. And there were some things which looked like cold-blooded murders, but that weren't being investigated, or that were just being whitewashed. And I was like, well, how can that be? How can you not look into something which looks like children are being killed?
The Brereton report, which was concluded in late 2020, says the SAS killed 39 Afghan civilians. That's the official figure. How many of those special forces that committed these murders were prosecuted or held accountable? And do you think that figure of 39 casualties is legitimate? Do you think it's accurate?
There's only one person who ever put on a uniform for Australia who was facing a trial and significant jail time at this stage, and that is me. And I think even the government finds that an uncomfortable fact. The report, as you know, was only finished late in 2020, and it wasn't a conviction of anybody. It was simply a non-criminal report, like an inquiry, which recommended charges, didn't even recommend charges. It recommended the police look at those 39 matters and, if necessary, charge people. And the wheels of justice, even when they're sort of being totally run honestly, take a long time. And it's quite possible we won't even have a trial on this until 2030. In relation to the amount of murders, I don't know that it was that many more, but it's a significant number because it wasn't, a lot of people must have known. And that's why it's truly significant, because you'd say a lot of people must have known, a lot of people must have said nothing, And not only that, what is more worrying than, say, if it had been a 300, was that often we rewarded the perpetrators of the murders. We gave them medals. We made them sort of media superstars. And I think that's the really sickening thing to say. Who gets ahead in our society? You know, the person that does the right thing, or the person who is the most sneaky, the most ruthless, the person that actually thinks our laws are just a joke.
David, are you concerned about Australia's geopolitical standing, its place on the international stage? Because a lot of people seem to see it as doing the bidding of the United States, being in this confrontation with China. Assange is another aspect of that.
It completely is, it does worry me a lot. We will never move forward as a country until we take a good hard look at what they euphemistically call the strategic relationship. The idea, and we—that means we just do whatever America wants. And the idea is that they will look after us, if we ever got invaded. But I mean, that's highly questionable. And I would rather stand on our own. They make us buy their equipment. They use us. Obviously, we don't have a very big army, but it has a very potent effect. And it means that when they go on these expeditions to Middle Eastern countries, that it doesn't look like they're acting on their own. So having Australia is powerful for them.
So Donald Trump, he sanctioned the ICC for investigating war crimes in Afghanistan. Israel is now scared that the ICC might investigate them. Do you think that Australia has handled the SES war crimes adequately? And if not, and I think I already know the answer, but if not, do you think that the ICC should be stepping in to prosecute military officials and politicians involved with that?
I believe the ICC, I believe that was the motivation for the Brereton report. That was the real motivation. I spoke to a senior lawyer back in 2014 and I said, what's going on? There's obviously some big cover-up. There's something strange going on. As I said, we're prosecuting people we shouldn't be prosecuting, and we're not prosecuting the famous guys that need it. And he said, we're worried about the ICC. And I didn't understand at the time. I thought, well, the ICC don't have any jurisdiction in Australia unless it's pretty serious. Well, I didn't realise that it was a lot more, it was serious enough for the ICC. They knew it back in 2014. And everything they've done since, because the ICC can't prosecute you if you have carried out prosecutions yourself. I think they think they're being really clever, because imagine it's not clear what carrying out prosecutions means. And so if you're carrying out prosecutions yourself for 50 years, that probably qualifies, you know, or whatever. By the time they'll all be retired, and the reason why the ICC scares them, the ICC has a tendency to go for the leadership. And this is how, you know, spineless our people are. They don't really care about the soldiers doing things wrong or whatever, but they worry that they might be in the frame and they might get before the Hague. And so they need to find some scapegoats fast, and they need to draw it out. And I think that was the really cynical motivation about Brereton, was to get, because unlike the US, we're a signature, we're, you know, this is typical Australia, going back to Maurice Payne. We can't sign up to these things quick enough. We sign up to anything, and we're like, oh, we're such a good nation, you know, we're signed up to the ICC. And I think a lot of the time, too, people just want to go on junkets to nice-sounding. Rome was where the ICC was put together. But they don't really think about what it means to be a member. And now the Americans have, of course, never signed up to it, and now we're backpedaling really fast. We will be complicit, even though we're a signatory to the ICC, a founding member, and the Americans, Pompeo's absolutely outrageous idea that he was going to put sanctions, that he made the ICC the bad guys, to try to make out that, like, the ICC were the criminals. Australia, of course, did nothing. And again, this is that creepy thing about you know, being the beholden to the US, we either need to get out of the ICC or we need to say something about that Pompeo's actions, and they're pretty outrageous. But I think that's the, unfortunately, you hang around, you know, the bullies long enough and you become like them. And I think the only reason, yeah, we even did the inquiries was to keep the ICC off our back. We didn't support the ICC when Pompeo was putting sanctions on them. Oh my God.
Because like you said, these investigations, they literally take years. And you also had the UK inquiry, Operation Northmore, where they're investigating war crimes in Afghanistan. And of course, no one is found guilty.
I think that's another good example. I'm glad you brought it up. I think that's what we're getting in Australia. And unfortunately, all these people who work in the government, they've seen the same playbook. You know, make a big noise about something for long enough, throw enough money, but then make sure nothing ever happens. It's the sort of thing they do with political investigations, you know. Whereas if you only care about public appearances, that sort of thing makes perfect sense. You know, if you're not actually trying to do the right thing, just trying to win elections, of course double dealing and mixed messages and playing one side off another, a bit like the American elections, you know, the partisan politics serves a purpose. And if public perception and opinion polling are your goals, your ultimate goals, why not just mess with the truth the whole time? You know, a trial is really just a way to look good temporarily. And if you have to have a trial but make sure the person gets acquitted, that's a win-win as far as these very cynical, you know, reputation management people would go. And pretty much everything that the U.S. not just the U.S. but all the Western nations is doing in the middle is a sham.
David McBride, thank you so much for your time. It's great speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your great work.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
The United Kingdom, which also invaded Afghanistan in 2001, is also embroiled in its own war crimes scandal. Britain's special forces, also named the Special Air Service, the SAS, were found to be committing war crimes going back many, many years. These war crimes involved many of the same things we just looked at, such as blooding or throwdowns, and were also systemically covered up by the entire chain of command. An inquiry was also launched called Operation Northmore, yet not a single soldier or politician was held accountable. These atrocities were reported on years before when the Sunday Times, in cooperation with the BBC, published internal emails showing that troops in Afghanistan were casually discussing these war crimes among themselves. For example, in late 2010 and early 2011, British Special Forces from D Squadron in the 22nd Special Air Service Regiment conducted several night raids in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. During these nighttime raids, they would regularly execute dozens of unarmed Afghani men, committing the most horrendous of war crimes with complete impunity. On February 16, 2011, the SAS stormed the house of a man named Saifullah Gharibyar. They executed his two brothers, his cousin, and his father. All his family members had been unarmed and were already in custody at this point when they were murdered. Afterwards, the SAS falsified their operational summary or OPSUM reports, claiming that these men had brandished weapons of some sort. They did this for practically every raid, these throwdowns. The report goes on to detail how British commanders became aware early on of a deliberate policy of executing Afghani civilians, particularly men. In one email published by the Sunday Times, a major in the SES remarks that there were more bodies than weapons. This clearly indicates that either the weapons had gone missing, or the men were never armed to begin with, and these reports were fabricated or falsified. The numbers literally did not add up. In another email, soldiers casually talk about the latest massacre, indicating how common these occurrences were. The UK's Ministry of Defense claims that a, quote, breakdown of communication, unquote, between the Ministry of Defense and lawyers is the reason that no action ended up being taken. Operation Northmore was set up in 2014 to investigate these crimes, and yet here we are in 2021, and not a single person has been found guilty despite all of these killings. How is that possible? It's extraordinary that none of these investigations, whether we're talking about Operation Northmore or the Brereton Report, have resulted in any successful prosecutions or convictions or even criminal proceedings beginning. How is it that Australian, British, and American special forces get away with murder, literally? The end result of this is that these actions not only disgrace the uniforms of these countries, but also blow a giant hole in the mission these countries allegedly came to accomplish. If their original goal was supposedly to bring peace and stability, this is not it. Executing unarmed men and getting away with murder literally is not nation building or bringing peace and stability and security to Afghanistan. It's a horrendous, brutal occupation that cannot be justified and is ultimately self-defeating. In some cases, when Afghan civilians were executed by special forces, their families were paid compensation by British and Australian troops, who did so without acknowledging any wrongdoing. If you look at the sums mentioned, in some cases it's around $2,000 or $3,000. According to the Sunday Times, in July of 2012, an Afghan mother named Bebe Harasta watched as British SAS shot dead her three sons, Noor, Deen, and Zahir Muhammad, in the courtyard of her own home. They were just farmers. The British then paid her £3,000 and just left. Of course, the British government denies any wrongdoing. And in another instance, reported by ABC, Australian Special Forces killed a man named Bismillah Azadi and his 15-year-old son Sadiq Allah while they lay sleeping. According to Bismillah's cousin, he found them dead and the bed riddled with bullets. The Australian Special Forces had left some cash with the corpse and left. Is that how much the United States, Britain, Australia think Afghan lives are worth? A few thousand dollars? This is not just repulsive, it's extremely insulting and dehumanizing. Foreign invaders come to Afghanistan, kill Afghan civilians in front of their families, pay them a few pennies, and then just move on to the next village or next town as if they did nothing. And the world stays silent and allows this to continue for decades. Is this it? Anyone with a shred of decency would be shocked and offended by what's going on. And these are just the things that we know of. More recently, there's a bill going through the British Parliament called the Overseas Operations Bill, which is extreme cause for concern. This bill seeks to eliminate accountability for British troops who commit war crimes overseas by introducing a statute of limitation of 5 years after the event has happened, if it's even investigated. This means war crimes, torture, abuses of various kinds would go unpunished, essentially. Not just in terms of the soldiers committing the acts, but all the way up the chain of command. No one would be held responsible. It effectively eviscerates accountability for war crimes and does nothing to prevent them in the future. It's an assault on human rights in the clearest sense and an indication that the British government intends to continue the trend of letting war crimes go unpunished. If there's one thing we've learned from these investigations, it's not just that war crimes have been committed with absolute impunity and that these horrific practices like blooding and throwdowns are going on, but that there's also been a systemic cover-up going up the entire chain of command. It's really worth thinking about what is more concerning here, the fact that these war crimes have taken place at all, or that military officials and politicians are able to get away with them and escape unscathed after failing to prevent them from happening in the first place and letting them continue when they knew the horrors that were taking place. Honestly, both are equally terrifying and equally unacceptable, most of all to the victims and their families. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
According to the new analysis by the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, and Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF, America's 664 billionaires now have a combined net worth of $4.2 trillion, a figure that stands in staggering contrast to the economic pain being felt by countless families across the U.S. as joblessness, uninsurance, and hunger remain sky high. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, news writer. This article is published under the heading, As U.S. Mourns 500,000 Lives, Billionaires Gained $1.3 Trillion During Pandemic. Here's more.